Today's program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. For more information, visit www.rt11.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, Internet. This is Kimberly Chow.
I'm Amanda Dell.
We are the co-directors of Food Book Fair, an annual, now biannual and bi-coastal festival of writing about eating. And we're also the co-hosts of Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair, where we talk about what we are reading, watching, and listening to in food media, and beyond that.
Yeah, we get to do that here at Heritage Radio Network. We are broadcasting live out of the back of Roberta's, and we get to talk about what we're reading, watching, and listening to with some of our favorite friends and collaborators. And today we are honored to have in the booth Allison Roman. She is a writer, she's a cook, she's a recipe developer. She wrote a short stack about lemons, which is on my shelf right now.
Good.
And she is the author of Dining In, her new cookbook released this fall. So after Kim and I kind of download a little bit about what we're reading, watching, or listening to, we'll jump in with Allison and hear what's on her nightstand.
Great. Amanda, what are you reading, watching, or listening to?
Oh, wow. Okay, we're throwing it right to me. I am ready, as I thought about what would be most interesting for this segment today, as I haven't been on the airwaves for a little while, but I'm very happy to be back. I did have a little downtime in the beginning of January, and I kind of just started looking at my own home library collection and wanting to reread something that I hadn't read for a while. I was feeling kind of a little, some twinges of sadness. And I was looking for a very depressing book to mirror that. And I
found
a little bit of wallowing, but it actually had the reverse effect, which was great. So I found two really sad books, Angela's Ashes and Tis.
Oh, God.
I forgot how much I love these books by Frank McCourt. Angela's Ashes is about Frank McCourt's childhood in Ireland. And Tis is about when he came to the U.S., I guess when he was about 16 or 17, and then made Manhattan and then Brooklyn his home. The books are so beautifully written, and I was feeling, as I said, sad, and like I was wallowing a little bit, and reading those books, I was like, wow. Amanda, don't feel sorry for yourself. I mean, the poverty and just the heartbreak that he describes in those books, and then just thinking about how he completely turned his life around when all of his circumstances were against him. I was just really, you know, in awe of what he accomplished. If you haven't read them.
I've never read Frank McCourt. I have to admit that.
It is truly excellent, and was a really good escape from just kind of looking out of my window and seeing kind of like the same trees and walking the same streets for a while, and then just getting to have a new mental image that this book describes so beautifully of like the lanes, which are like the streets of Ireland, of the neighborhoods. And, you know, the stories range from like his alcoholic father, like the family like waiting for him at his job so that he doesn't go and drink all of the money that he earned, to like him becoming a bike messenger for telegrams, and like describing him just bicycling all around the countryside of Ireland. So really vivid, descriptions, and it was a good escapism for me when I was laying low.
I'm glad that worked for you.
Yeah. What about you? What have you gotten into? I see something piled up on our desk.
Yeah, these are old copies of The New Yorker, which actually I think I might have caught up on, but I'm perpetually behind.
Dave! Can we get a clapping for someone getting caught up on The New Yorker?
Okay. Quiet storm.
Yes. That is so good. I'm impressed.
I love The New York Times and my delivery on the weekend, the Sunday Times, which is split. If you get home delivery between Saturday and Sunday, that's my great pleasure. Though someone was stealing the paper from my lobby, so I was trying to strategize. So I called the Times, and I was just like, fuck this shit. I'm going to cancel it. And somehow within the 5 minutes of me trying to cancel in order to subscribe with a different username and credit card number and therefore get like a discount deal, they just offered me the same deal. And then somehow I ended up subscribing for 3 days a week instead of just one.
Sneaky.
And then I also subscribed to the Wall Street Journal. Every year around this time, I go through a sort of re-up of magazine and newspaper subscriptions, some of which become automated, and then I forget that they are until a year later. There's some sort of charge on my credit card, and I forget why this magazine keeps coming. But I find a lot of pleasure in reading on paper, and I read faster, and I think it's better for my sleep schedule. But as a result, on the weekend, when I get the Times and the Wall Street Journal on the weekend, it's just like a giant mountain. So it was nice. I was working from home yesterday, so it was nice to spend part of my morning on Monday. I'm trying to do this thing, at least for the first few weeks of the new year, of starting each day not looking at my phone and email for the first half hour or so, and doing my practice of drinking various hot beverages and stretching and then reading and doing some personal writing. So I've been slowly making my way through the papers that way.
Loving it.
I'm an old newspaper person. That will never die.
I love reading the newspaper. I do it on Sundays too. It's
great.
It almost feels like a guilty pleasure, but
it's not a guilty pleasure. There's no guilt involved. It's just making you smarter.
Yes.
Yeah. Media is folding in on itself, mainstream media as we know it. But God bless the print paper. So I've been reading and catching up on the Journal. There was this crazy story, but totally believable and also hella petty story, because it was in the Journal, about Wendy Deng Murdoch perhaps being a Chinese spy. And how her friendship with Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump was maybe impacting American security. But Wendy Deng Murdoch, previously being married to Rupert Murdoch, who owns the Wall Street Journal, and that story appearing on the front page last week, that was sort of like a media gossip moment. But I feel like if anyone was going to pick a prominent Chinese business person as a spy, Wendy Deng would be such an obvious choice that it almost doesn't make sense. But that was delicious.
Forward it to me.
I don't know how to, like, I only have the print one. I think there's an online password that I can give you though. So I'm reading that. Yeah.
Great.
It's all analog over here. And then Spotify playlists and what they've been sending me lately. I didn't realize I'd subscribed to Tidal. Again, this is the problem with automatically renewing payments. So convenient, but, you know, you forget about them. But I had been subscribing to Tidal for about 6 months now and had never not actually used it. I just forgot it was there. And also, the logo for Tidal looks like... Did you ever watch Twin Peaks?
No.
The owls are not what they seem. There's like this like dark mark, Harry Potter-style dark mark that characters get when they're abducted to the Black Lodge. Anyway, the Tidal logo looks like the logo that signifies the owls in Twin Peaks. Anybody listening to this that also has my specific interests and understands this reference, let me know. So that was sort of distracting, and I thought it was funny. But I watched a bunch of the videos on Tidal before I finally canceled it, including Blues Freestyle, which perhaps you remember from the Jay-Z album 4. 44 or 444, however you want to say it. But the one where the hook goes boom shakalaka, I never saw a ceiling in my whole life.
Not familiar with it. Full disclosure.
You got to look it up. I thought we were sharing a title subscription, but but there's an animation for it.
Oh, cool.
Let's go.
I will check it out.
Cool. It's only available on Tidal, though. You can try the free trial, though.
I'll do that. So, speaking of what we're reading, watching, or listening to, we're going to throw it over to our guest for today, Allison Roman.
Hi.
Welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Whoa, welcome.
Welcome to Recommended Reading.
Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
So, let's get right into it.
Okay.
What are you recommending for our listeners? What have you been getting into?
Well, I'm in just starting two books right now.
Oh,
one is for home, one is for transit because it's paperback.
Oh, wait, let's discuss this a little more. You have two books. One is for home and one is for transit.
One simply could not sustain me, so need two. Well, I wanted to read Little Fires Everywhere, and I asked the people at the bookstore, when is this coming out on paperback? And they're like, not for at least another 9 months, which I think is unusual. Typically, they release a paperback about a year, but I think it's because it's so popular, they're just continuing. So that's my bedside reading. I'm about 9 pages in. It's fantastic, but can't really speak to it. And then I'm reading Call Me By Your Name because I saw the movie and I loved it, and I wanted to read the book afterwards, which is not any... Right. I've never experienced that before.
So you went movie-book.
Movie-book, okay. Yeah. And I actually think... For anyone that's seen it and maybe has read it, it's actually kind of the move because the book reveals a lot more about what the characters are thinking. It's a little bit more upfront with what's going on, and I think the movie is a little bit more playful and leaves a bit more mystery. I mean, it has to because it has to build and sustain people's attention, but both are beautiful in their own ways, and I've already cried multiple times in the subway, so it's going great. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I love it. So highly recommend. Yeah. And then, that's what I'm reading right now. I try to read other, newsy type things that are not Twitter.
Right.
Anymore. I'm on a Twitter vacation, which doesn't mean that I'm not looking at it, but I'm certainly not looking at it as much as I used to, which is a real victory.
That's great. Yeah. I had to take a Twitter vacation at the end of 2017, and I haven't been able to figure out the password ever since.
Great.
On my
Just
phone.
Just leave it that way.
Yeah, forever. I know. I look at it on my desktop, and people are like tweeting at Food Book Fair, and I'm like, I should have responded to this 19 days ago. But the thing is, I deleted it from my phone, and the icon is a blue square, and then Venmo slid into its place on my lock screen or home screen or whatever. And for days afterwards, I was like, by muscle memory, clicking on Venmo to see what the news was.
No money coming
That's
in or
like
out,
That's fucked
though,
up. So, yeah. No money coming in or out. Just more bad news.
Is a Twitter vacation a thing?
I think a lot of people have
now.
Been taking social media vacations, especially in the last year with news just being flaming piles of garbage
and
vitriol.
I was on actual vacation, and when I was on actual vacation, I didn't look at Twitter because I was on vacation,
right.
And I didn't have internet service, and et cetera, et cetera. And it just sort of carried over when I came back from vacation, which it's been great.
That's really good.
Yeah.
Well, is this a Mexican vacation?
It was a Mexican vacation.
Because I did see that on Instagram.
Yeah.
It looked fun.
It was a lot of things. It was fun and therapeutic and interesting and delicious and warm.
Where did you go?
I went all over. I was in Sayulita and then Mexico City, then Oaxaca, and then the coast of Oaxaca.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, it was great. Highly recommend.
What did you read while you were on that trip?
Well, that's actually, it's not, I'm not going to say it's embarrassing, but I've... It's a little, I don't know why I'm feeling embarrassed now because it.
There's nothing embarrassing that can happen on our show.
That's good.
Okay.
So it's a book that somebody recommended that I read, and then like 18 more people recommended that I read it. So I'm reading it. It's called Women Who Run with Wolves. And it was written in the 90s. And it's this woman who, I'm paraphrasing here and I'm probably not doing it justice, but breaks down several. Stories, either mythological or folklore or religious, with women at the center of the story. And, in the beginning of the book, she kind of explains how oftentimes I'm so unqualified to talk about this, how so often our modern fairy tales are derived from actual you know, stories that had happened, and they were a lot more sexual, and they were a lot more fierce and a lot more violent than they were transformed into. And so she kind of gets back to the root of those stories and the power that women had in those stories, and how we need to go back to harnessing that power and just kind of focusing on how strong and intuitive and fantastic women are.
Now, did you read Aesop's Fables when you were growing up?
No, but I'm familiar. Yeah.
Apparently, like, that a lot of those stories are where we get our kind of like children's stories or fairy tales. But as you were saying, in its original form are much more violent and disturbing.
Oh, completely. Yeah. They're horrifying. But Grimm, it's great.
And the Brothers Grimm.
Yeah.
Little Mermaid dies.
Yeah. Or Little Match Girl. Right?
Spoiler.
That's Hans Christian Andersen. Yeah. He was also on a little bit of a depressed tip. Okay. That's
good. I read that, and I read Her Body and Other Parties, which I am obsessed with, and was so sad when it ended because I wanted to read it 500 more times, but ended up giving to a friend on that same trip at the end when, you know, we parted ways. But it's such a, if you haven't read that collection of stories, it's amazing. I haven't found one person who disagrees with me, but I loved that book so much.
I love that feeling at the end of being, I usually, when it's something is really good in the last few pages, I'm like, ah, the ending. And I'm so happy, but also so sad that it's over. And to be able to give it to someone else is a great, great
But I better
get
it back because it was signed.
So that's what I was just going to say. So you, our guests have been very divided about whether or not they lend books or not.
Oh, I'm a lender for sure. Yeah, I lend it with zero expectation that I'll ever get it back because I think if this were me, would I ever give it back? The intentions are there, but that's not happening.
Right.
So, but this one I sort of was like, I'd like that back, please. But I think that books should be shared, and I think that especially if they're loved and worn, as this one was, it serves good purpose to pass it on to somebody else.
Yeah. Well, I distinctly remember we had Stephanie Dandler, the author of Sweet Bitter, and forthcoming
who has blurbed your book and
Sweet Bitter TV on Stars.
Very exciting.
She does not lend books out.
It's probably good for her. She probably has all her books, whereas I have. You know, the second you go to look for one, you're like, oh, I definitely am never seeing that again. But
I'm chasing some books now, but I'll still lend them out.
If you're listening and you have one of my books, please return it. Thank you.
I don't lend anything that's signed or that I have like a special relationship to, but I try to, I'm like a aggressive book pusher.
Yeah.
I think that's true.
Yes, this is true. But another book that I was so happy to read and sad that it was over, and I've been thinking about buying it again just to have that pleasure. And I left it in an apartment in a different, like a sublet apartment in a different country a couple years ago. And then I was talking to somebody else who also read it. A Brief History of Seven Killings by Marlon James. And that was also a really, I started reading it in New York. Oh, there's a special guest.
I was just saying bye.
Someone you know.
Hi, John.
I love this picture window here.
Everyone can see you. I bet they're very curious what we're talking about.
Books.
It's
books. But I started reading A Brief History of Seven Killings by Marlon James, and I tried to finish it before I moved to Taipei 2 summers ago. And then So I was like burdened, quote unquote, burdened with it on the subway because it's like 900 pages, even though it was a paperback. It was still just taking up a lot of room. But it was so good. I had to keep carrying it everywhere because I just loved reading it.
Well, that goes back to my hardcover book for home, paperback.
Yeah. This is genius. Genius.
But then I took it with me somewhere else, and then I just ended up leaving it because I bought too many random ceramics and teas and things, as I do when I travel, and then I didn't have enough room.
Well,
but I might buy it again because I just recommended it again to somebody else, and I'm like, I would love to have the pleasure of reading that.
Totally. Do it. Speaking of books,
I wrote one.
Allison wrote one.
Yeah, I did.
You've been on book tour all over the place for this.
I have. Yeah, I sort of took the holidays off, and then I went on said vacation, and now I'm kind of back on the scene. I'm going out to D.C. and Baltimore on Friday. And that should be really fun because haven't really ever spent much time there. But, it kind of just continues forever, maybe.
So was dining in your original concept for your book? Or how did you know you wanted to write a book? And was this how you envisioned it?
Well, I had been writing about food for so long and writing recipes and cooking for so long that it seemed inevitable and natural that I would write a book one day, and didn't really know exactly what the book would be, but knew that I didn't ever want to have too defined a concept, only because I feel like that's not really the food I do, and that's not really the style of book that I read. Mm. And so I was actually approached by my editor at Clarkson Potter, who said, all of my favorite recipes are yours. And she kind of just noticed after a time that, you know, ripping out the pages of Bon Appetit or dog-earing things, and all the ones that ended up being her favorite had my name on them, which she said took her too long to realize. But you don't always look at the byline of a recipe, especially if it's, you know, being published in a place like Bon Appetit, where you generally probably like everything in it. So she approached me, and then I got an agent, and then we wrote a proposal, and then we sold the book to her. She's like, you should write a book. It doesn't have to be with me, but it maybe should be. And it ended up being the best home for me and for the book. But yeah, so the concept kind of just came after the fact. And once I let go of the idea that I didn't have to have like a hook or an angle necessarily to the book, then I felt a lot more free to just create a book of really good, cookable, useful recipes for people, which is what I wanted. So yes, and it turned out just like I wanted, and I'm so proud of it. And really excited for people to be cooking from it, which they seem to be.
Yeah, I see a lot of internet and Instagram love for the recipes.
For an analog thing, it sure digitized very well.
Specifically, shortbread cookies. Chocolate chip shortbread.
What are those?
Cookies.
No, I'm just, yeah, I know. It's kind of crazy. I honestly cannot keep up with the amount of people that are making them. I am blown away. And people, it's so funny when things become popular, you get turned on almost immediately. People are like, are they really worth the effort? Are they really worth the hype? It's like, yo, I don't know. I didn't say that they were. Other, you know, people kind of started making them and I paid attention, and it snowballed for sure. And I mean, I think they are an amazing cookie. I wouldn't have put them in the book if I didn't think so. But it's just funny when that kind of thing happens. Mm-hmm. People love it. And then they're like, wait a minute. Is it really that? I'm like, you be the judge. Maybe it's not your favorite cookie. Maybe it is. I don't know. I hope that you like it, is all.
What for you makes the cookie distinctive and delicious?
Well, it only has a few ingredients, which I think is important, because I don't think that, especially for a cookie, that you need many more than what's in that one, which is salted butter, brown sugar, sugar, vanilla, salt, and flour. Well, I guess no additional salt, but, and then chocolate. And then, you know, I think a shortbread is the perfect cookie. I grew up kind of being obsessed with those Swedish cookies that you get in the tin that are in individual papers, and some are shaped like pretzels.
Danish.
And some are Danish.
With the sugar on top.
It's like the blue.
Yeah. The royal Danish. The royal Danish.
I'm so sorry. Can we? I think it's Danish. Is live. No one can edit that. Yeah. I think they might be Danish. Yeah. Sorry about that. But
I don't know.
Oh, God.
I'm sorry.
We're going to have to do a quick Google on that. If we could get somebody on that. Yeah, anyway, those cookies are fantastic. And I thought that they would be better with chocolate. So that was sort of the inspiration behind that. But also, like I said in the book, and I'm not trying to be inflammatory, I just have never had a chocolate chip cookie that I went crazy for. I think they're flawed. And I think this is better.
What was your favorite shape of cookie in the sugar butter cookie of the blue tin?
The pretzel.
Okay.
Yeah,
it was so shiny.
Cute, right?
Kind
I mean,
of.
Maybe it was a bow. I don't know. Looked like a pretzel to me.
Yeah, it seemed to have
Let's call it a pretzel.
It seemed to be the biggest in my mind, and then have the most sugar crystals. Yeah,
but I think also because of the shape, it has the crispiest parts. Yeah, which is another important characteristic of my cookie, which gets rolled in crunchy sugar, and then the edges get really nice and crunchy and crispy.
Oh. I've got to make these.
You got to make them. I can't believe
I'll do it.
Neither of you have made them.
I know. I feel bad.
I should leave.
Totally.
This is embarrassing.
We're sorry.
I'm just kidding.
Has anyone brought the cookies to you? At a book event? Yet?
No, actually. That's really interesting. I mean, if I were them, I'd probably not. You know, I'd be like, oh, either she doesn't want to see that, or like, I don't know, if I went to an event where somebody was sort of known for a thing, I don't know that I would bring them the thing, but I would love if they did. If anybody wants to do that, I think that would be awesome. I've been to parties before. I went to a cookie swap, like a ladies' cookie party, and my friend texted me and was like, FYI, I'm bringing your cookies, so you can't make them. I was like, well, what am I going to make now? I had to figure something out. I think I ended up bringing Pocky because I was running late. So
that's a cookie.
Ooh, yeah. That's clutch.
It counts.
Yeah.
It counts.
That's actually a great subversion of the cookie swap.
Yeah, it really was. It says I care, but I also am so busy. No, I'm just
also,
kidding.
There's it, like it 40 really sticks in a box, you know?
Yeah, there were a lot. Definitely not the best thing there. So that was also a good sign. People really brought their A game.
What about homemade Pocky?
Ooh, I don't think.
I'm going to file that one under not worth it.
Hashtag not yeah. worth it. Okay. Given that you have such an extensive background in recipe developing and recipe testing, how did you approach the recipe testing for the book? I think sometimes I have just have been recently working on a project where I was called on to recipe test in a pretty mm-hmm. simple way, but I really had no idea how much went into recipe testing.
Yeah.
And
it's a whole other beast.
You know, creating a recipe that people can and want to cook from that's successful for them, mm-hmm. you know?
Well, so, the developing and the testing yeah. are two different parts. Okay. And for this book, I outsourced my testing because I can't really test my own recipes because I'm developing them. So that's sort of the rule. If you're developing, you don't test.
What exactly is the definition then of recipe developing? Like the concepting?
Yeah, the concept. Okay. What is the dish? How is it cooked? You cook it from scratch. You just start cooking and you write your measurements down and your times and what vessel you make it in and mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera. All the, you're developing something that has previously not existed.
Okay.
And then once the recipe is written, then I hand it to somebody and I say, cook this. And then I have, you know, sort of for this process, I have a sheet that I gave to everybody that tested for me that said, here's what I'm looking for. Here's what you need to look for. Here's the information I require. Here are the notes that I'm looking for to make this successful for me. And the idea when testing a recipe is not to create a perfect plate of food, but it's to kind of find any flaw or mistake in the recipe. Like, oh, you say to cook it for 4 to 6 minutes, but it actually took 8 to 10. Or you say golden brown, but it kind of just burned. What did I do wrong? And, you know, mistakes that a person would have or conceivably a mistake that somebody at home would have. And you're not going to catch everything. And, you know, with having a public forum for mm-hmm. people to kind of ask you questions like they do on Instagram, I am seeing a lot of, you know, there's things people have questions about that I wouldn't have thought of otherwise, even though they were tested. And it's been really eye-opening. And, you know, there's also like a recipe in the book that's missing a step. But when it was tested, the step was there. So somehow in the editing process, literally just one sentence got cut and we don't know where it went. And I don't know when it happened. Yeah, it ghosted on me. because I was like, wait, I tested this. And I looked at the notes and I was like, well, yeah. It was here at some point. But anyway, so developing is more conceptual, conceiving, starting something from scratch, having ownership over something. And then testing is making sure it works. So oftentimes people say, oh, I'm a recipe tester. And, you know, there are people that exclusively test recipes. And they do it, you know, for the New York Times or for Bon Appetit or for other publications, for cookbooks, for publishers. And they are handed a manuscript or 5 recipes from a story. And they are simply cooking and looking for error and just making sure that they work.
It's the fact-checking of the culinary world.
Yeah, it really is. It's a super, super important step. And that's kind of how I got my start at Bon Appetit, was just doing that. And starting there really helped me learn what makes a good recipe and what doesn't. Because when you're testing, you're like, wait, why am I doing this in another skillet? Or why am I using 3 pots during this thing? Like, could we streamline? And that's sort of the next step. That's the evolution of testing, is kind of thinking, is this the smartest recipe? Is it working? Am I working harder for it than it is for me?
Yeah, I mean, I like that line in your book where you say, I think it's on the back of the book where you say, I'm never going to ask you to cook a chicken in 2 skillets if you only need one.
Yeah.
Which I appreciate kind of someone attitude, with a New York kitchen.
Yeah. And, you know, I've thought of it. You know, yeah. It's like, do I really need, it's like, probably. If I'm asking you, then probably. Only because I've tried to find the path of least resistance. I'm a pretty lazy cook. Like when it comes to doing it day in, day out, so.
You grew up in LA.
I did.
And you're living in New York now.
I
and
am.
Yeah. So something you said earlier to me was it's kind of like I wanted to do a book about the way that I cook or mm-hmm. the recipes that I am drawn to or mm-hmm. that I've created. So where did you get a lot of the inspiration from? Like, are some of these takes on recipes you grew up with? Are some of them takes yeah. on your like things that you had in LA or things that influenced you when you came to New York, or like, and how did, was this all in your head? I mean, I know a lot of your recipes were in Bon Appetit and other publications.
Yeah, but not from this book. There aren't. Yeah. So the ones from the book are new. There's maybe two exceptions where I kind of took something that was that I felt really truly was the best way to cook something, kind of explained why it's in this book, even though you may have seen it elsewhere, but everything else is brand new. And, yeah, I mean, I think it's like with anybody, if you're a musician or a writer or a cook, and you just draw on all of your experiences from travel to childhood to kind of what do you crave? What do you want to listen to? What do you want to eat? What do you want to cook?
Right.
And from there comes this table of contents that, you know, I would say was 85 to 90% of things that I had never cooked before in my life.
Oh,
but,
wow.
But sounded good to me.
Okay.
And then there are some dishes that are riffs on, you know, fish my mom cooked or a thing that my dad makes or, you know, me missing tacos. So here's like a very inauthentic version of an al pastor for me, you know, that you can make at home. And, you know, I think that...
Don't need to bury it in a box.
No box required, no spit required, although that does make them really great. So I think it's like any creative process. You kind of just... draw on your experiences and what is appealing and attractive to you. And I try to stay away from what is too trendy. I think especially when you work in a magazine or you're writing for a newspaper or something, you can get bogged down and it gets a little intense with thinking of what do people want right now and what's cool and popular right now, because those things don't always age well. So I think it's important to stay true to yourself and kind of, I'm hoping that in 5 years, these are still cool and fun. But also, a book is 2 years old, essentially, by the time it comes out. So it has to be a little timeless. Otherwise, it's going to always kind of feel dated.
Right. So about that, what in your conception and in conversations with photographers and the designer for the book, what were your goals and what were your inspirations when you were coming up with how the book would look?
Well, I was really, really lucky because I got to kind of handpick the team that I worked with, from the photographers, Nicole and Michael. They're amazing. Nicole, Harriet, Michael Graydon, full names. I've worked with them before at Bon Appetit, and we just really clicked. Mm-hmm. And I'd worked with a ton of photographers, all of whom are extremely talented and have their own thing and their own vibe. And they just, I feel like, really got me from the beginning, and I got them. And they were such a pleasure to work with. And I knew that whatever vision I had, they would hopefully be excited about. It wouldn't take convincing or too much explaining. And we spoke actually very little. I showed them some mood boards and kind of explained verbally what I was looking for. And they were like, cool, got it. And we just kind of created stuff. And some things we were like, this isn't working for me. And they're like, I don't love that. And we'd move on and do something else and try new things. And I think being flexible when you're creating something like this is of the most, it's just the most important, because it's never going to be exactly how it feels on your mood board or in your brain. You know, you have to really be open to letting things change and be flexible. And Amy Wilson, who was also on set, did the props for this, and she's incredible and works really well with Michael and Nicole. And it was just a really awesome team to be a part of. And then when it came to design, I felt even more lucky because I got to pick my designer, which is rare. And her name's Elizabeth Spiridakis, and she and I used to work with each other at Bon Appetit many, many years ago. She had since moved on, was working at another magazine. Now she works for Kate Spade because she's a total badass lady. And she just kind of understood from the beginning, because she knew who I was, like what the book should kind of look and feel like. And I think after the photography started to come in and how strong and colorful it was, that the design was going to be a little bit more quiet and kind of complement it rather than dominate it. And I think it takes a really skilled and adult and talented designer to understand that, because sometimes you just want design to be so aggressive and dominant, especially if you have a passion for it. But to kind of let it be a little bit quieter and let the photos be part of the design is really special. And I think she did an amazing job. And, you know, overall, I think just the vibe for me, I wanted it to feel really fun and happy and bright and messy and real. And I made all the food in the book, and, you know, it was really happening. We were really cooking. It was almost all natural light. It was really the sun, making it look like it's in the sun. And, you know, I wanted it to feel authentic, and I wanted it to feel like me.
After you, Allison, Elizabeth is one of my favorite people to follow on Instagram.
She's amazing. And she just has the best. I don't know. She's great. She's one of like the. She was a blogger for a long time, I think. And
that makes sense.
She just has. Her captions are witty, and I just like watching what she does. Her stories are great.
Stories are amazing. Yeah. She actually moved to the town where I lived for a while with my family. So sometimes like she'll post.
I'm at
Village Trattoria, and I'm like, oh my gosh.
I used to go there. Yeah, yes. She's great. I love her so much.
Yes. I was going to say about the book, like, it's really beautiful, and the look of it is, like you said, really natural, and it doesn't feel intimidating. But there's also a lot of writing in this book.
Yeah, there are a lot of words.
A lot of words.
Yeah, one of my best friends the other day, he said to me, he goes, literally 2 days ago, he goes, you know, I've been reading your book. I was like, you've been reading my, I was like, what do you mean? You've had it for 4 months. What else have you been doing with it? He's like, well, I mean, I thought I would just look at it every time I wanted to cook, which is never. He doesn't cook ever. And he's like, but I really just, I spent the morning with it and I read it and it's so good. He's like, it's so funny. It's so you. I'm like, well, I'm better now than never. Thank you so much. But it's true. I wanted it to have, you know, I wish there was more writing in it, and maybe for the next one there will be. But, you know, I kind of had to take some essays out to fit more recipes in because I wanted that to kind of be the forefront. But yeah, it's, I don't know. There are a lot of words.
It's a good thing.
Yeah, I think so too.
Something that we talk about all the time is that some of our favorite cookbooks are not even something that we take off the shelf when we want to cook, but more just that we want to read or get inspired or use it as a starting off point for something else. Or if we're looking, you know, sometimes like I have a persimmon like hanging out in my fruit basket right now. And I'm like, not only do I have a persimmon, I also have my microplane that's up and running. Oh, not my microplane, my mandolin.
I was like, girl, what kind of microplane is
battery
this?
Operated? Or
hey, that's a different show.
Yeah.
but my mandolin, and it is like, I finally got all the finally got to the point where I've used it enough where like I know how much to move the dial like for each particular thing, and I'm like totally in charge.
Really dialed in.
I'm dialed into my mandolin.
You can do that with your knife.
Yes. But I was like, oh, I think I would use the mandolin to do this.
What recipe is that for people that can't see?
Yes. I will share for the airwaves. Persimmons and pears with blue cheese and spicy pecans.
Mm.
Yeah. I love it. But going back to like, we've known each other, but I didn't know so much about you. So
do you feel like you know more about me now?
Yes.
Okay.
Completely.
Well, when I started cooking and when I was a wee baby, I read cookbooks every night, and that was sort of, it was on my bedside table constantly. And that's really how I learned how to cook. And I wasn't really cooking from them, but I was reading them. And the ones that I loved the most had the most words and sort of the how and the why and the personality and the story. And obviously this was before blogs. So this is sort of how you got that same kind of content and information, and reading Alice Waters and all those things, and memoirs and cookbooks, and that's sort of how I got inspired to cook in the first place. So I really thought, you know, it would be my biggest dream if this book served as a utility, like a utility book, and was in people's kitchens and was messy and gross and like was there all the time, but also if it was at your bedside table and that was what you read before you went to sleep.
Let's talk about some of those other favorite things before blogs after a commercial break.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Yeah, gotta remember to do the commercial break because we're Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported public radio station on the internet at heritageradionetwork.org. This station supports more than 35 different shows all about food, in and around food, school food, brewing, fermentation, books. So you can go to heritageradionetwork.org to support what we do and what the many, many hosts, producers, engineers do here if you love good food media. We'll talk to you in a bit. Thank you.
following program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Route 11 Potato Chips dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate, an incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Route 11 Potato Chips believes comfort food should be just that. Know where your food comes from. For more information, visit RT11.com.
Hey, we're back. This is Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair. I'm one of your hosts, Kimberly Chow, and I'm with our other host,
Amanda Dell.
And we're here with our very special guest, Allison Roman, the author of Dining In.
Hi.
Quick one on our Instagram post of you for the show earlier today. Yeah. Someone must know, at Snacks in the Stack says, beautiful dress. Where is it from? It's a photo of you that is in your book, I believe. You're holding drinks.
You're popping bottles.
Yeah. It actually didn't make it into the book, but I used it for promo stuff because it didn't really feel like it belonged in the book, but I still thought it was cute. So
you look great. It looks like you've got a really nice entryway.
Yeah, that's not where I live, but it is a nice entryway. That is from Reformation, where a lot of my clothes come from. Mostly when I get compliments on an outfit, that's where it's from.
At Snacks in the Stacks, if you're listening, it's from Reformation.
Yeah, they don't give me any money to say that either, which is a real disappointment because I keep working give them it. All of my money. So
yeah, we talk about Sven clogs on air sometimes and hope that
I have those too.
Yeah, yeah.
Give us all money or clogs.
Yes,
I'm working on that. But we were just talking before the break about the time before blogs, and also in the time post blog, about the inspiration that cookbooks and other kinds of food books that can bring beyond utility. And you mentioned Alice Waters. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about specific Alice Waters books or other books that sort of brought you to where you are now, or started the baby version of you into the accomplished cook, chef?
Well, part of me is still the baby cookbook. Me, but I'm working on it. I think that so she had a memoir book. I can't remember the title, but that was not the most recent one, obviously. But it was more about when she started Chez Panisse and what that was like for her. And it really spoke to me. I had already been working in restaurants at the time. And at that time, being a woman in a restaurant was even more rare than it is now, which I guess is not as rare. But it was still, you know, I was oftentimes the only woman in a kitchen. And that felt a little alienating. And so to read the story about a woman who was not only working in a kitchen, but working in her own kitchen, and how she kind of just decided, well, I'm going to do it myself. And that was really inspiring. And, you know, how food was sort of just a huge part of her and everything she did. And also, this was, again, before being that into food was quote unquote cool. Like, nobody, when I told people that I was a pastry cook or I worked in restaurants, they were like, oh, why? Like, why would you do that? And it was sort of like hired help, you know, like, oh, she works in a kitchen. It was a very weird perception of what I did. And I think now when people say I work in a kitchen, it's really cool. And, oh, what restaurant? And I love that place. And it's just a different time. I'm talking like 10 plus years ago. So, And also, I mean, I read the French Laundry cookbook all the time, and I never cooked anything from it. I think I tried to make the risotto from it once, but it wasn't something that I read to actually cook from, but just kind of the way that they explain things and why they do things kind of informed my decisions and my curiosity and made me want to kind of take those things and apply them to whatever it was that I was cooking, which was a lot of rice because I was poor.
And hence rice the risotto. Is delicious.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, the books that I was reading at the time, I mean, there's a chef called Michel Bras and he wrote this really fancy dessert book, and that's what I read. And again, wasn't cooking anything from it, but it was an important part of my education. And, you know, all those cookbooks that were coming out 15 years ago were the ones that I was reading. And, you know, most of them I've left. When I moved out of LA, I kind of purged my entire apartment and didn't travel with most of them, which I regret because I wish I remembered which ones that I was reading now, but I can't. But yeah.
I think we can kind of agree that restaurants are pretty popular. We talk about them.
We're at one right now.
We are actually. We're an extension of a restaurant right now.
But your book is really about cooking at home for friends.
Fuck. I just broke the microphone.
Situation over here.
Don't mind me. Just keep going, guys.
We will.
Yeah, it's definitely a home cookbook for sure. And that was very important to me. And there are many, many excellent home cookbooks written by chefs who work and own, work at or own a restaurant. And they're fantastic, but that's not what this is. This is very much by a home cook for a home cook, even though I used to be a professional cook.
When did you start hosting or people over, and was that a part of your life early on?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up, my mom hosted all the time. She was constantly entertaining, and that kind of energy in the house was always really appealing to me. And as soon as I had a place big enough to have more than four people over at a time, I started doing that. And, I'm a big fan of the last minute dinner party, having people over, as I call it, and no one else calls it that. But the idea that it's not actually stressful, it's actually very calming for me to have a house full of people and to be feeding them. And a lot of the dishes in this book lend themselves really well to large format cooking, and I wanted them to be a good mix of you can double this for a party or serve this whole pork shoulder, or it's great for leftovers if it's just you or you and another person. And to be kind of flexible to encourage people to say like, oh, this is actually very easy and all I have to do is stick it in the pot and it's ready. And to kind of demystify what it means to cook for more than just another person or yourself.
What's your idea of the perfect dinner party at your place or at someone, or you love being a guest too?
I love being a guest too, but I prefer hosting. Okay. Sometimes, I have a few friends with apartments that are much nicer than mine, so I like to cook there. But there's something that is really empowering about hosting somebody in your own space, and you can control the music and the lighting and where people sit and what people eat on and kind of the vibe. You can kind of direct the entire thing without being a crazy person. I guess direct is really the wrong word. Kind of curate is even the wrong word, but encourage a certain mix of people to come, and people that may not know each other, people that haven't seen each other in a while that would otherwise not get together if it weren't for you hosting them. And people feel really relaxed when they come over because I think they know everything's kind of taken care of. And when I go to people's house, if I'm not familiar with them in their hosting style, I get really nervous, or I like eat before. I'm like, we don't know when we're going to eat. It could be 10:30. Got to be prepared. Like, can't get too drunk. Can't be hungry. Got to put snacks in my purse. What if there's not enough food? And I kind of start to panic. And when I'm at home, I feel a little bit more relaxed because I know what's happening. Although I do get nervous when I invite people that don't know each other and I have to leave the room for a minute to do something, and I'm like, oh God, are they talking? Are they not? Is it weird? Did I make it weird? Oh God. That's when I get anxious. It's the people, not the food.
Right.
I love the concept of eating beforehand, which I frequently do out of.
It's a pre-meal snack. You never know what's going to happen.
You never know.
Yeah.
Eat some rice to soak up any... soak up the booze.
Just come prepared. You can't be the first drunk person. You can't be the last person there. You got to master the art of being a guest as well as a host.
Yeah.
What do you bring when someone invites you, someone has you over versus the other way around?
Mm.
Beyond booze.
Well,
I usually bring booze.
I always ask, what can I bring? And then I follow that up with a be honest, because you know that there's something you can bring. And sometimes they're like, nope, just you. Or like, can you grab a bunch of parsley? Or we ran out of limes. Or can you bring seltzer water? And if they give me no direction, then I'm going to bring wine. And I'm going to bring a cool bottle of wine. I'm going to bring the wine that everyone wants to drink. I'm going to bring like the special bottle. Mm. Or a bottle of, a cool Amaro or something like that we can drink at the end of the night. But you want to bring the thing that everyone wants to drink, not the thing that you're trying to unload because somebody gave it to you for free.
Yeah. So... This is something that I've run into. If you bring something to a bottle for a dinner party, is the expectation that you're supposed to open it that night for the party, or can the host like
squirrel it away?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You don't take the bottle when you leave. So I kind of just drink what I want to drink first, and then anything left over is left over.
Okay.
But I've never squirreled away a special bottle that somebody else brought and saved it for myself to like drink alone. That's not really my style. I'll drink whatever I'm most excited about first.
That's
followed by what I'm second most excited about.
So aside from wine, do you love cocktails? You mentioned Amaro. What?
Yeah, you know, to say I love cocktails would be probably an overstatement. I enjoy them.
Okay.
I love a Negroni. I love an old fashioned. I'm pretty classic when it comes to cocktails. When I go out, I drink martinis. I would never make a martini at home. Someone asked me the other day, what's your favorite martini recipe? And I was like, if you think I'm making a martini at home, even though my friends that all are professionals would say it's actually so easy and you can store it in the freezer and it's really great. And I'm sure that it is. And all those things are true. I'm just never going to do it. It's just not for me. So if I do make a cocktail or if I do make something, it's more of a punch. I'm more of like a fizzy punch kind of person. Fizzy and boozy and lemony. I do that. I've made a lot of cocktails with kombucha, which I'm sure people hate when I say that because they're like, you can't do that.
And, I was doing that a lot this summer.
Yeah, and I do, and it's awesome. this summer I want to get a shaved ice thing and do like Campari shaved ices.
That sounds great. Invite Kim and I.
Yeah. I mean, again, probably file under never going to happen, but sounds cool, right? I would do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say ice luge, and I was still going to say
or an ice luge. Never in my home, but would I have participated and would participate again in an ice luge.
It's been a little while for me.
But yeah, I'm a wine person. I enjoy a beer every now and then, like a Budweiser or a High Life, but I'm like a wine person. Yeah, but now I'm old, and I can't drink as much wine as I used to. So,
well, we know what to bring you.
Yeah.
Wine.
What kind of pocky do you like?
I like all pocky. I want like the weird flavor. I want the limited a dish pocky. I want pocky for men, which is a real thing.
I love pocky for
what
men.
What flavor
pocky
is that?
It's a pretzel pocky. A pretzel pocky. It's a pretzel pocky dipped in the darkest chocolate.
And that's pocky for men.
Pocky for men.
And sometimes it has crushed almond.
Oh, yeah, yeah, crushed almond. And it's like hysterically sexist and gender discriminatory, but for some reason, because it's pocky, I find it charming. Like, they just didn't know. Like, they, like, misbranded it. It's like something was lost in translation. And they're like, oh, is that offensive? We don't know. We're pocky. We're so sweet. Because how could they be sexist? They're pocky. But there's no pocky for women, if that's what you're asking.
There is, however, regular matcha pocky. And then there's, like...
Cookies and cream is excellent and a totally slept-on flavor. Strawberry, also awesome.
I, there's the pocky regular matcha, then there's also like dark matcha or like extra matcha.
Whoa. I have not explored. I have 18 boxes of pocky in my living room right now if anybody wants to come over.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
You're ready to have people over and dine in.
Yeah. We're all dining in with pocky.
Pocky, if you're out there, please sponsor.
They've reached out. They love me. I love you too, pocky. Let's get a pocky for women out there. Am I right?
I think it's
heard
like
it here first.
When Chrissy Teigen got sponsored by Taco Bell because she was tweeting about them, and then they would like send her filigree like rings and necklaces that said Taco Bell.
Yeah, that's kind of the dream.
Pocky at Pocky USA.
You can, we will accept Pocky in all its
Don't
forms.
Send us the Brazilian orange because I've had that and that shit's weird. Though.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Don't
wow.
Brazilian
Good
orange.
Good Pocky feedback. Well, I think we might have to leave our Pocky party here
for now
as our time is up. Again, thank you so much, Allison, for joining us. Congratulations on your book,
Dining In. Thanks for having
me. And we hope if you don't already have it, you pick it up, you try out some of the recipes, have some friends over with some wine, and have a good time.
Yeah, that's what it's all about.
Available at fine bookstores.
Everywhere. Every bookstore.
On the internet.
Internet, bookstore, all over the place. Yeah.
And you can also find more information and follow her adventures here and elsewhere at Allison Roman, Allison with one L.
E. Roman, Allison E. Roman.
Allison E. Roman, yes.
Yeah. You'll find me. I'm out there.
There's only one.
Yeah, it's true. It's just me.
Well, thanks.
Cool. Thanks for having me, guys.
Of course. All right. Till next time.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.